V'ata titzaveh es b'nei Yisrael v'yikhu eilecha she'emen zayis zoch kosis lamor lahalos ner tamid. Now you shall command the children of Israel that they shall take for you pure pressed olive oil for illumination, to kindle the lamp continually. Dot, dot, dot. Zachor eis asher asah lecha Amalek baderech b'tzeisachem mimitzrayim. Remember what Amalek did to you on the way when you were leaving Egypt. OU Israel presents
Come in. Welcome.
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky, and this show is for Parshat Titzaveh, which is also Shabbat Parshat Zachor, and recording and first broadcast is Yom Chamishi, the 7th of Adar, 5775, the 7th of Adar being the birth date and yahrzeit of Moshe Rabbeinu, Olav HaShalom. And there's an interesting connection there we'll get to in a moment. But before we continue, well, that corresponds, by the way, to February 26th. And February is running down faster than any other month. This Shabbat is the 28th. Sunday already is March 1st. Tehillim Kuf Lamed. And I'm going with the opinion that you do say Tachanun on Zayin Adar. There are a lot of people who don't. But we'll do Kuf Lamed Psalm 130. Shir Hama'alot Mima'amakim Karaticha Adonai. Adonai Shimavakoli Tichyena Oznecha Kashuvot Lekol Tachanunai. Imavonot Tishmor Yoh Adonai Mia Amod. Ki Imacha Hasalicha Lama'an Tivarei. Kiviti Adonai kiveta nafshi velidvoro hochalti. Nafshi ladonai mi shomerim laboker, shomerim laboker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai ki im Adonai ha chesed vaharbe imo fedut. Vehu yifde et Yisrael mi kol avonotav. Achinu kol beit Yisrael hanatunim batsarao vashivya haomedim bein bayam uvein bayabasha. Hamakom yirachem aleihem v'yotzieim mitzara lirvacha u'me'afela la'ora u'mishibud l'gu'ula hashta ba'agala u'vizman kariv v'nomar amen. Now, I know that I really should talk about Parshat Titzaveh first, because we read it first in the first Torah of the two which we take out for Shabbat. And that follows the rule of Tadir Vesheino Tadir Tadir Kodem. When you have two, in this case, Torah readings, the reading of the weekly portion and the special reading of Zachor, Tadir Kodem, the one that's more frequent, weekly readings, goes first. Nonetheless, I want to focus on Zachor, and if we have time towards the end of the show, to also speak about Parshat Titzaveh. I mentioned briefly, maybe we'll start with that, that the coincidence of Moshe Rabbeinu's yahrzeit with Parshat Titzaveh, it doesn't happen every single year, but in most years it's thereabouts, is considered significant, because Moshe Rabbeinu was born as baby Moshe back in Parshat Shemot, Shemot Va'era Bo B'Shalach Yitro Mishpatim Teruma. Seven parshiot that we've had so far have had the word Moshe repeated many, many times, his name. And from next week, Ki Tisa, and onwards throughout the rest of Shemot and all of Vayikra and all of Bamidbar, Moshe Rabbeinu's name occurs many, many times in every Sedra. In Devarim, not so many, and there are Sedras without the name Moshe, and that's because he is the first person narrator, and he does not refer to himself by name, but he says I or me or whatever. But from beginning of Shemot through Bamidbar, there is one Sedra conspicuously missing Moshe Rabbeinu's name, and that's the Parsha of Tetzaveh. There are several different reasons, and the reasons vary greatly in the picture they make in your mind. The first is based on something that Moshe says in next week's Sedra. Next week, Ki Tisa, among other things, has the account of the golden calf fiasco, which I choose to call it. And in the aftermath of the sinning of with the golden calf, God says to Moshe, I'd like to destroy the entire nation of Israel, and I'll start all over from you. And Moshe says to him, to God, if you will not forgive the people, and if you were to destroy them, God forbid, then erase me from the book which you have written. God's reaction, so to speak, was, watch what you say, because God is capable of doing that. And even though Moshe did it as, so to speak, a threat to God, and God acquiesced, again, I have to say, so to speak, because these are human attitudes and actions, not God's, but we speak of God in human terms very often, anthropomorphically. And God says, I won't destroy the people, I will forgive them because you have asked, but you should not say things like you said. And as a token reproach, this is one opinion, as a token reproach to Moshe, Moshe's name was left out of one particular Sedra. Why Tetzaveh? It could be because that's the one that is closest to his birth date and his yahrzeit, which means we associate Moshe with the 7th of Adar. It could also be, and this I like a little, that Moshe said it, wipe me out of your book, in Ki Tisa. God was going to punish Moshe by removing his name, but was reluctant to do so in Ki Tisa and the next Sedra and the next one. And the final Sedra, starting with Ki Tisa, cycling all around through the Torah, is Tetzaveh. And God says, I'm sorry, but I have to pull your name out to show you that you're not supposed to say things like that, so to speak. And I'll pull it out at the last available Sedra, which is Tetzaveh. Because once you get into next week's Sedra, which is the Sedra in which Moshe said, erase me from your book, God has to already have done that, and that would be in Tetzaveh. So it's either because it's the last in the cycle, starting with Ki Tisa coming back full circle, or because it's close to Moshe Rabbeinu's birth date. On the other hand, there is another possibility, which even has two different ways to look at it. Let's keep the reproach first. Way back at Moshe's first experience with God at the burning bush, God says he's sending Moshe into Egypt to tell Paro, let the people go. And Moshe keeps declining. Choose somebody else. I have a speech impediment. I stutter. I can't do it. And he kept up with that so much that at a certain point, God said, okay, you said it too many times, so your brother Aharon is coming to see you, and he will be glad to see you, and you will be glad to see him, and he will go with you to Paro to represent, together with you, myself, and the Jewish people. And so it happened. And Aaron is rewarded, so to speak, with the kohuna, the priesthood, I hate that word, and with the status and rank of Kohen Gadol, and not Moshe. Moshe should have been Kohen Gadol, and had he not insisted that God send somebody else, he might have been, he would have been, both like a king and like the Kohen Gadol. But now that was being shared by with his brother. And Aaron becomes the Kohen Gadol, and Moshe functions for the first week of inaugural procedures in the Mishkan as the Kohen Gadol, without special garments, which are described in Parshat Tetzaveh. But he functioned that way, and the culmination of that functioning as Kohen Gadol was, sadly, maybe, that he was now to give over the mantle of the kohuna completely to Aaron and his children, and the rank of Kohen Gadol, the position of Kohen Gadol, to his brother Aaron. And he, Moshe, was to dress them in the Kohen's garments, which could have been his. So again, that gives it a reproachful slant. But now here's the other side of that coin, which I like better. And that is, Moshe was 3 years younger than Aaron. Moshe was the one who went up to Har Sinai to receive the Torah by himself. And he is clearly on a higher status than his brother Aaron, notwithstanding the fact that there are a few times the Torah will mention Aaron u-Moshe, Aaron and Moses, rather than the more common Moshe v'Aaron. You can't get away from the fact that in most situations, Moshe was top. Aaron was top status as Kohen Gadol. And therefore, the Parsha, which speaks of the honor and the glory of Kohen Gadol and the Kohanim, that is the one that Moshe's name is missing from, perhaps as a statement of his acquiescence and even happiness for Aaron. And he's willing to step out of the spotlight and let the spotlight fall on Aaron and then his sons. So instead of saying at the beginning of the parsha, Vayedaber Hashem el Moshe le'mor, it says, Vi'ata, and you, Moshe, without mentioning the name, and you shall command the people to bring olive oil for the lighting of the menorah and be in charge of the fashioning of the garments for the Kohen Gadol and for the Kohanim, and later in the Seder dress them. But you're not mentioned by name in order to give the honor of this Seder to Aaron. Aaron's name is mentioned more in Parsha Tetzaveh than any other Seder in the Torah. So that's a different slant as to why Moshe's name is conspicuously missing, but the fact is, it is missing from Tetzaveh. So whatever reasons of the ones that I gave, whatever you like, you can use as your reason for it. But they all have input from different sources, and they all have a value in understanding the dynamics of Moshe and Aaron. A side comment, which really isn't a side comment, it was made by somebody in Torah Tidbits, one of the columnists, I think it was Raquel Berenbaum in her portion of the portion. And she was quoting, I think, Rabbi Yonatan Sachs from his Sefer. If I got that wrong, I apologize to whoever needs to be apologized to. But she wrote about the terrible, this is my wording, the terrible scorecard of siblings, older and younger brother, starting with Cain and Hevel. We know what happens there. Continuing later to Noach's sons, Shem, Ham, and Yafet, what Ham did and what Yafet and Shem preserved the honor of Noach. And then you have Avraham and his brothers, not bad, but they were different. But then you have Yishmael and Yitzchak, and then you have Yaakov and Esav, and then you have Yosef and his brothers, and it basically goes all the way through the book of Bereishit with a not complimentary examination, if you want, of siblings. Till we come to Moshe and to Aaron, and actually Ephraim and Manasseh, perhaps because of the bracha that was given to them by Yaakov, and the bracha that we give our children, naming Ephraim and Manasseh. But clearly a beautiful example of brothers that complemented each other, even though they had different personalities and worked very well together, were Moshe and Aharon, Aharon and Moshe. So that comes out from this Sedra also. I said I wasn't going to do Parsha Tetzaveh first, but I feel as if, in case I don't get to it, I've done something with it. Okay, let's get into Zachor. Zachor is the command to remember what Amalek did to the children of Israel on our way out of Egypt. And then the next verse describes it, and then the command to destroy the remnant of Amalek, and the partner warning to Zachor, you must remember, of Lo Tishkach, you shall never forget. The mitzvah, as presented in the Torah, leaves the question, how are we supposed to fulfill it? All it says in the written word is, remember what Amalek did when you came out of Egypt. Chazal, our sages, fill in the big blanks as to how we are supposed to go about doing it. And when there is a mitzvah in the Torah which the sages teach us how to fulfill, then that's the way we have to do it, and not our own way. You can't write a poem about Amalek's attack on Israel, or about Haman's attack or plot against the Jewish people, or about Hitler and the Nazis singling out the Jews among their other enemies for the final solution, or the Inquisition, or the pogroms, or anything that we have in Jewish history. You can write a poem about it, you could recite a poem about it, and it could be a way to remember and not forget, but it is not the way, capital T-H-E, it is not the way to fulfill the mitzvah of Zachor. What is the way to fulfill the mitzvah? Chazal designated the Shabbat before Purim for the reading of Parshat Zachor in public. This Shabbat, we take out two Torahs. In the first Torah, we call seven people to Parshat HaShavua, which is Parshat Tetzaveh. Different years, there are other parshiot that match up with Zachor. It's not always Tetzaveh, although Tetzaveh is a common one. And in the second Torah, instead of reading a maftir in the first Torah, which is the repetition of the last 3 to 6 psukim, instead we take out a second Sefer Torah, which we already took out, and we read in there to the person called the maftir. We read in there Parshat Zachor, which is a short 3-verse portion from the end of Parshat Ki Teitzeh in the book of Devarim, which, as I read before, starts with the verse Zachor et asher asah lecha Amalek baderech b'tzeitechem mimitzrayim. This is a mitzvah which is a Torah fulfillment by the reading of the Torah in public, when all the rest of Torah reading throughout the whole year is a rabbinic command. The Torah is the Torah, and the rabbis, the sages, have commanded us to read the Torah on Shabbat afternoon, on Monday morning, on Thursday morning, and on Shabbat morning, and on Rosh Chodesh, and Chanukah, and Purim, and Chagim, and Chol HaMoed, and fast days. And all of that is a fulfillment of a rabbinic command to read the Torah in public, with the exception of these three psukim on this particular Shabbat of the year, called Zachor, where the fulfillment is that of a Torah law to remember. Now, there is a discussion as to whether women are obligated on the Torah reading of Zachor. Let's boil it down without going into the full details. Let me boil it down by saying that women, some say, are obligated, some say are not obligated. But one way or the other, if they somehow miss hearing Parshat Zohar read this Shabbat, they have an opportunity, and this is an opportunity not really available to men, but women have the opportunity to come early on Friday morning in Yerushalayim, Thursday morning everywhere else in the world. See, I almost slipped. And hear the reading of Purim morning, which are 9 verses from the end of Parshat Bishalach, which is the original story of what happened with Amalek. Vayavo Amalek, vayilochem im Yisrael birafidim. Amalek attacked, and they attacked the stragglers, etc., etc. And Yoshua gathered an army at Moshe's command and fought against them, and God joined in the fight, and there's more to talk about, which we'll get to. Approaching halftime, we'll continue with more Torah Tidbits audio for Parshat Zohar and Tetzaveh momentarily. I am speaking to you now at the end of the show, not at the beginning, even though you're hearing it at the beginning of the second half. I went way over time on the second half as well, had to cut out the beginning, which had Popeye the Sailor Man theme song, and you could make your own connection to Parshat Tetzaveh for that. And I gave some kind of long-winded introduction to the way the rest of the show is going, but I think it'll be understood if you hear my next words. But at this point, I will already in advance wish you a Shabbat Shalom Lehishtameah. But keep listening. So what's going to happen immediately now is the continuation of what I was saying about Zachor, and then after this, I will continue fresh. So a woman who should, let's put it like this, a woman should make an effort to get to shul this Shabbat to hear Parshat Zohar. Shuls are very accommodating in this respect, because most shuls will, right after davening in the morning, have a reading of Parshat Zohar again, in case a woman missed it at the regular piece of time. And at Mincha later, there will also be a reading of Parshat Zohar for anyone who is not able to be there in the morning and had missed it. So that's mostly available to women. There are men who also, for some reason, couldn't hear it in the morning, and they come to hear it at Mincha time or right after the davening, and it is a fulfillment of a mitzvah, whether you're obligated as a man or maybe obligated as a woman. In addition, women have that option of hearing Vayavo Amalek from the morning of Purim. We, of course, men, have to hear the reading, but we have already fulfilled the mitzvah of Zachor, and it becomes the reading of Purim morning in order to connect it with the Megillah, which is the story of Haman and Agagite, Agagi, a descendant of Amalek. So there's the connection. Till now was from the end of the first half, which spilled over, and now I'm continuing afresh for the second half. The question that I want to focus on now, and I must tell you, this is not brand new to me, but it definitely was refreshed, which is a reason to go over material every year. And I find it a particularly important concept. Let's take a couple of steps back. The portion of Amalek that we're going to read this Shabbat contains three out of the 613 mitzvot. The first one is to remember what Amalek did. The third one is not to forget. The second one is to destroy Amalek. Let's take a look at that one first. Whereas the first and the third mitzvot, and many mitzvot in the Torah, are for the individual Jew, the command to destroy Amalek is for the Jewish people. When we have a Sanhedrin, when we have prophecy, when we have a king, when we are fully or almost fully living in Eretz Yisrael, probably a Beit HaMikdash also, no, maybe not, because one of the jobs of the king was whatever. So let's leave it at that, but let me emphasize that there is no obligation on an individual to kill a person who he thinks or knows is an Amalekite. This is a command for the Jewish people. And I am not suggesting and I am not inciting against any of our present-day Amalek, which, sadly, there are. This is sort of what it says in the Haggadah of Shelo Echad Bilvad Amar Aleinu Lechaloteinu. It was not only one person who rose up to wipe us out. Ela Shebechol Dor Vador, in every generation, Om Dim Aleinu Lechaloteinu, there are people who get up in order to vanquish us. V'HaKadosh Baruch Hu Matzilenu Miyadam, and God saves us from them. I need to say here, it really belongs later, but I don't want to forget it, that sometimes God saves us from the Amaleks in the world without our suffering a loss, with hardly a scratch. The Purim story is a great example of that, and it really is an important thing to think about. Haman desired to destroy every man, woman, and child, the nation of Mordechai. He failed miserably. His plot was revealed, and he was hanged for plotting against the Jews 11 months before his plot was to be hatched. We had other problems. We had the decree of the king, which he refused or could not rescind, hanging over us for those 11 months. But the threat from Haman, the plot of Haman, failed, and we still look at what he tried to do. That's important. Attempted murder and murder are different, I think, in the perception of human courts, but they really aren't different in the bigger picture, whether that means in God's eyes or in our just looking at the bigger picture. The attempted murderer failed, not because he didn't try, and not because he didn't want the person to die, because circumstances prevented it. Those circumstances could be divine, they could be natural. Usually that means natural with God behind the scenes, or God intervening, but no thanks to the person who attempted to destroy. As I said, in a human court, those two are treated differently, murder and attempted murder, and all the other attempted whatever. But we shouldn't look at it like that. Now, I am removing from the set of mitzvot here to destroy Amalek. Again, I say that's a Jewish people thing, and in the absence of a Sanhedrin and a Melech and a Navi, and whatever else is necessary to carry out those kind of commands, we still must be, as a nation and individuals joining the effort to protect ourselves and whatever is involved in that, but not as individuals, as part of the nation. And I'm talking about today's threats that face the Jewish people also, and anti-Semitism, etc. So don't take this as any kind of incitement to go out and beat up or kill a terrorist, or you could kill a terrorist to stop him from doing what he's trying to do, but you can't kill a terrorist per se. He needs to stand trial, etc., etc., and that's not up to the individual to do something like that. And this goes for the nation of Iran and their nuclear program, and it goes for Hezbollah, and it goes for Hamas, and it goes for ISIS, and whoever. This is a world problem, a nation problem, and we are individual members of the world community and the nation of Israel, and we have to do our share, as I said before. But it's not the same personal, individual command that we're talking about. So let's go back now to the other two, to Zachor and Lo Tishkach. Zachor, I told you, Chazal, our sages, defined how it's to be done. Annually, Shabbat before Purim, Torah reading in public of Parshat Zachor. There is a myriad of other ways that we remember what Amalek and Amalek types have done through the generations. These belong a little bit more, perhaps, to Lo Tishkach, not to forget. Not to forget is not a yearly thing. It's a sort of amorphous, all-the-time kind of thing. And when you read about the Holocaust, or a new aspect of it, or new information has come to light, or the continuing hunt for Nazis, or reading about the Crusades. I'll tell you, just on a personal thing, I picked up a book which has fascinated me. I'm in the middle of it now, called The Jewish Pirates of the Caribbean. It is not a novel. It is a history book, and it presents a period in the 1500s and later of after the expulsion from Spain, how many Sephardic Jews who left Spain looked for all kinds of ways to take revenge against Spain and what they did, and some of them took to piracy. And it's just a fascinating study. So it's Bechol Dor V'Dor, in every generation, back to Lo Tishkach. Lo Tishkach means you don't forget what Amalek did, you don't forget who Amalek was, meaning the first nation to attack Israel when we came out of Egypt. The Amalek himself, a person, the progenitor of the Amalek people, was a grandson of Esav. Esav, who we've spoken about before, Halacha hi biyadua she'esav sone liyakov. There's an enmity from Esav to Yaakov where he wanted to kill him. He had not succeeded. He charged his son Eliphaz to do further damage, and he didn't succeed. And his grandson, I picture sitting on Esav's knee and being told by his dear grandfather how he must carry on the fight against Yaakov and his descendants, and that created the Amalek mindset as well as the Amalek nation. And this is, as I mentioned before, a perennial thing. The Torah says, Milchama Lashem ba'amalek mi dor, from generation to generation. Comes in different shapes and sizes and forms, but it's still the same thing. So part of Lo Tishkach is never to forget a myriad of things. Part of it is also not to forget God's promise that he will fight with us against Amalek, and that he has repeatedly fought with us, either actively, obviously, miraculously, or behind the scenes, pulling the strings, but he's always there. And part of never forgetting is not just what Amalek did, but that God protects us and fights with us. As I mentioned earlier, sometimes, and I got diverted to the Haman failing in the plot, and there no body count at all from the Jewish side, and unfortunately, or sadly, or tragically, and can't use any words that would do it justice. The fact that one-third of world Jewry was decimated during the Shoah, the protection was not that complete and exclusive, but the Jewish people survived and continued to thrive. That also we need to thank God for. There's a third aspect which is very, very significant, and this is really why I'm telling this whole thing. And that is never to forget the cause of our being vulnerable, this is the way I'm putting it, of our being vulnerable to the Amaleks of the world. What did the Jewish people do to deserve, in quotes, Haman's plot to kill every man, woman, and child? Haman had a vendetta against one person, Mordechai, who refused to bow to him. And when the point was made that he's not bowing, not because his knees hurt and he has arthritis or he had a knee replacement or he needs physiotherapy, but because he was Jewish, it was despiseful in Haman's eyes to strike out just at Mordechai, because the members of the king's court had made a point of saying that he was Jewish. And therefore, Haman desired to destroy every man, woman, and child, the nation of Mordechai. There are similar stories that are told about where Hitler's rage and obsession about a final solution came from. It was not from suffering from the Jewish people. It was a perceived slight from, or because of, an individual Jew or two. And then it just blew up from there. That's a typical kind of thing that we have to remember and never forget. But what did we do to become vulnerable? The expression is, Sherafu Yedei Yisrael, or B'nai Yisrael, Min HaMitzvot, or Midivrei Torah. Our hands were weakened from our lack or diminished observance of Torah and Mitzvot. Now, I have to be very clear on something here, and I made a phone call before the show to make sure that I'm saying it in the right way. I am not talking about individual Jews. Why did X happen to individual Jew Y? It has no necessary correlation between that particular Jew's observance of mitzvot or the lack thereof as to what happened to him. Good people and bad people and religious people and non-religious people and Torah observant people and Torah desecrating people sometimes survive and sometimes don't survive situations, and you cannot measure or judge a person, an individual, based on what happened or didn't happen to him. Because when we're talking about Yedei B'nai Yisrael, we're not talking about individuals, we're talking about all of Israel. All of Israel has a divine reckoning on an ongoing dynamic basis as to whether we, I don't know if this is the best way to put it, whether we find favor in God's eyes by Torah observance and faithfulness to God and mitzvah observance. And this is not necessarily a numbers thing. It's not necessarily a percentage of the people who are this or who are that. It's a general perception, again, not the greatest word, by God, as to whether we find favor in his eyes or not. And when we do, there are a lot of bad people who are benefited. And when we don't find favor in God's eyes, he allows evil to happen. And sometimes the most undeserving individual of a bad thing can happen to that person too. So I am not trying to explain the Shoah. I am not trying to say how many observant people they were or non-observant people they were and how many secular Jews and how many assimilated Jews. That was not the issue. The issue was the full Jewish people and what God allowed to happen or not. And that's part of Lo Tishkach. As a mushel to offer, I must have said this in the past in a different context, I would like you to imagine a 16-year-old boy who just got his driver's license, and he sneaks his father's keys from him and goes on a joyride without his father's permission in his father's car with his friends, and one of the friends brings a six-pack of beer, and everybody is drinking while this kid is driving. Yes, he has a license, but he's not really experienced, and he ends up wrapping the car around a tree, and the result is very serious injuries. Let's not discuss the other people in the car, but let's say him. This kid, 16-year-old, new driver's license, took his father's car keys, drank while driving, and wrapped the tree around and sustained serious injuries. There was an immediate operation. There was a follow-up operation to correct something. There was months and months of physiotherapy and all kind of other therapies until finally, a full year after the accident, the boy has been returned to full health. And the family is very happy. And the parents make a party for the son to celebrate his return to full strength and health. Now, there's got to be a point somewhere or somewhen that the parents, maybe they did already, maybe they still have to or whatever, have a serious talk to this kid about taking father's keys without permission, driving without permission, and drinking while driving, and taking his friends in the car, and maybe speeding, and maybe doing other kind of things that resulted in the serious injuries. They will not discuss this with him at the party. That would sort of be party pooping. That would be counterproductive. So either before the party or after the party or a month before or a month after, a day before, a day after, I don't know, they will have serious talk with him and maybe send him to counseling, etc., but not the party itself. Why do I tell you this, mushel? Because I think of Purim in that way. We need to explore what the Jewish people did, the Jewish people in the kingdom of Ahasuerus, to fall prey to Haman's plot. A separate question is, what did they do right to be spared the consequences of that plot? That also is all part of Lo Tishkach, and we're not going to do any of that on Purim itself. I believe that's part of what Ta'anit Esther is for. The day before Purim is a fast day. It's not a sad fast day. It's not a mournful fast day. But it is a serious fast day. A sobering fast day, pun intended. And therefore, that's a day that's appropriate to dwell on these things, or the week before, or after, whatever, not on Purim Day itself, but it needs to be explored, and it needs to be remembered. And this kid in my mushel needs to always remember that accident and what he did to bring it about, and how God spared his life when he could have been killed. So in a mushel form, that backtracks to Amalek and to Haman, and to, really, Amalek with the Lo Tishkach. You shall not forget what Amalek did, you shall not forget who Amalek is, and that God fights for us, and that we have to improve ourselves so that we do not become vulnerable to Amalek.